This is Dr. Z, Zachary Brooks, and this show is called The People Behind the PhDs. This is Dr. Z, Zachary Brooks, and welcome to part 3 of the interview with Dr. Mark Whiting, who combines design and computation to build systems that augment our collective psychologies and philosophies at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California. There's a few seconds of overlap, so we can pick up right where we left off in The People Behind the PhDs.
Product. But a lot of the decisions we make are not based on really good data. They're just based on somebody sort of flipping a coin and saying what they prefer. And of course, in some circumstances, human preference is a really good signal. But in other circumstances, it's not a very good signal. And that ends up getting in the way of doing good design. So I've been, for many years, interested in how we can do this better and how we can do it faster. So like, is there a way that we can get really accurate decisions? And is there a way that instead of us taking us several months to make a design, is there a way we can do it in like a really short time, like maybe one day or less than a day? So computational tools help with both those things, where we can formalize things and we can measure them and we can set them with an algorithm, but also by using an algorithm can do it much faster. So when I started my PhD, that was sort of the vision that I had, and that's what I wanted to pursue. The way I pursued it changed a little bit over time, but actually the core tools that I used were pretty consistent.
So there's a couple elements there. So you talked about design, decision, and signal. So one signal for a design is preferences, but you said that's not always the best option. So then you're basically putting in lots of data to decisions to create a better signal for design.
So some other examples of signal could be like how comfortable something is.
Okay.
If I designed a product that's really uncomfortable to use, that's useful data for me to know that I should change the design. But another signal, which is maybe a very obvious one, is how well something sells or how excited people are about it in the market. And we constantly see products that are delivered to a market and then people don't really care about them. And so often we can use design to differentiate those products and update them so that they become exciting.
So yeah, I still want to drill down because this is just the limit, obviously, of my understanding about this. So signal has a very clear definition in your world, and comfort. You said comfort can be an example of signal, but how would you measure comfort, for example? Like what statistical or just descriptive statistical qualities would you apply to comfort?
Yeah. So this is kind of exactly the problem that I was thinking about when I started my PhD, which is that, many of these things that we'd love to optimize to get good design, we don't really have good quantitative analysis for. We can't measure comfort very easily.
Okay, such as comfort. Yeah, got it.
Yeah. And it turns out that actually people know this, and people have worked in this field for a long time. So there's many ways that people do measure comfort and measure other things about satisfaction with products and services that are also really exciting. And so, sometimes that's through an interview process where we might interview a customer. Sometimes it's through observing a customer using something or a user using something. And sometimes it's also through sort of a bulk analysis. So something that, some designers do is they'll go and read reviews on a website like Amazon.com to try and understand how their product is working and also how others' products are working, like what's working for other manufacturers or other designers. So there's a lot of nuance in how we get this data. There's many, many sources of data, many of which aren't very clear. And so we have to do a lot of interpretation to make sure that we're gleaning the right kinds of insights from what we're looking at.
So when you say do interpretation, the tool to do the interpretation, in this case, is statistics, I'm kind of guessing at. Is that one of the ways you get at it?
Ideally it would be statistics, but actually in many cases, it's just guessing, right? We just look at, for example, you might look at some reviews and be like, oh, it sounds like people feel this way.
Okay.
So there's a lot of informal knowledge and informal practice in the way people design things.
So the guessing becomes an anchor by which you can then test things and go back to guessing and then test, you know, and then test again and based on that guess. So you can do kind of this,
Ideally, that would happen.
I'm just trying to conceive it as a model. Okay, got it.
Yeah.
So I started, go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, in practice, a lot of that doesn't happen. And, you know, traditionally, a lot of products are designed with very little insight in what actually was good. This is changing. And so in the last 10 or 15 years, it's started to be much more data-driven in our design work. And, you know, part of that is some of the movement in computational design.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay, so I started off the show by saying that your research focuses on understanding how to improve decision-making and coordination at individual team side of scales. And we've kind of touched on that. But some of the examples that I'm reading through your abstracts to prepare for this interview were about crowd workers and crowdsourcing and these kind of things. And so one example, so people who don't know, Amazon is maybe the best known, has something called MTurk. And Amazon's definition for that is a marketplace for work that requires human intelligence. So basically, if you're a researcher or just a business person who wants to get information and do a quick survey to, you know, kind of guess at your market or your audience and so forth, you can go online through MTurk, Amazon's MTurk product, ask questions, choose your demographic, and get feedback very quickly from, you know, basic sort of surveys. So that's what that is. And what, Mark, I think you've been looking at in your research is the kinds of people who sign up with the MTurk program or other kind of sources, other kinds of services out there to offer their services to participate in surveys and get paid for it. And so you've kind of studied some of those folks and the interaction interface between those folks and the people who are looking for feedback from the world. Is that kind of where you're going with some of this crowd worker research?
Yeah, so yes and no.
Okay, thanks. And sorry, it was kind of a long meandering thought, but I'm just trying to understand where you're coming from on this research. So
crowdsourcing is a really interesting tool because it lets us engage a lot of people very quickly so we can get a lot of survey responses very easily. But it also lets us study social psychological phenomena because these people are people too. And, you know, we can ask them to do things, for example, chat to each other. And when they do that, we can see, you know, possible trends or possible behavioral elements that are really interesting. And a lot of communities are using this tool now. Many computer science and many social science communities leverage crowdsourcing in order to get insights in how people work or code data or many other things. Now, one of the challenges here is that other people use these tools too. For example, companies use them. Just an example of that is that many companies who provide receipt scanning services don't actually do that automatically. They use a human to do it, or they cut it up into thin slices and then they send a slice to each human and they get humans to write down what they see. And that works, but that marketplace is not regulated. You know, it's not regulated in the way many other labor markets are regulated.
Mm-hmm.
And as a consequence, many people underpay the workers, or they treat them poorly in other ways. And so we've studied that a little bit, how people are treated or maybe how we could change the design of such a platform to make sure that people are treated better. A big part of that is that the nature of these systems works very effectively when the workers don't communicate. If you think about your Uber driver or something like this, it benefits Uber for them to not talk to each other and just drive. So Uber has built things into their tools that make it easier for the people to just drive instead of sitting around talking to other drivers. In part because if they did do that, maybe they'd start to find out things about the way Uber runs that wouldn't be good for Uber.
Stories. Stories are humanity's original technology. So I'm proud to carry on the traditional technology and share this story with you. Whether you're on an iPhone or an Android, whether you're on Apple, Spotify, or another podcast service, whether you're at home, in your car, at work, on public transportation, working out, or just walking around, I dedicate my shows to you. Dr. Z Productions and Podcasts, Consequential Stories for Life.
So to clarify, so one example of the crowdsourcing thing, not the Uber one, is that someone could be asked to do a survey for $1 and they're told it's going to take 5 minutes, which extrapolates to $12 an hour, like a decent minimum wage, let's say, but in fact it takes them 30 minutes. And
sure.
That's how they
yes.
can exploit a particular worker. They're getting a dollar wage for 30 minutes of work, for example.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and to be specific, there's no minimum wage on Amazon Mechanical Turk. There's no mandated minimum wage by Amazon.
Wow.
And it's not covered because of the nature of the contract that you have with these workers. It doesn't fall under the standard minimum wage employment guidelines in the United States. So you can, you know, you could feasibly have work that costs almost nothing. Now, people might choose not to do it, but in a limited market, people will end up doing things that are against their best interests. So that's a big problem. That's one thing that we've studied. And there, of course, we're studying Amazon, but we're also studying the more generic notion of how do we build systems that let people have sort of good societal constructs in an automated world, right? When we have things like an automated labor market, such as Amazon Mechanical Turk, what can we do? What kind of features can we add that let us keep many of the positives of our long experience with designing proper labor markets outside of these worlds? And so that's one perspective. I've also studied a very different perspective. I think of that first one as sort of very large scale, right? This is like big community level problems that we are navigating.
Yeah.
I've also studied smaller scale stuff. So for example, how do individuals interact and what do those interactions do to their long-term engagements or even their like long-term success at particular activities. This is a very different angle on the same notion, but it's coming from a small scale perspective.
Okay, so what would be an example of an interaction two people have mediated through a computer or not that would have some sort of long, you know, downstream behavioral output or something? Not output, but result, let's say.
Sure. So we have been studying kinds of collaborations very similar to what you might see in a modern company that has remote employees, where, for example, people are using a chat interface like Slack or WeChat. There's many others, but one of these chat interfaces to collaborate.
Okay.
And we've been studying how they collaborate in these environments and what happens. Whether or not the failure that the teams see, which they often see for various reasons, is due to who's on the team or how the team is interacting. So, like, is this way of interacting a problem, or is it that we have something about who we choose to be on our teams that ends up causing us bigger challenges?
Mm.
So there's a lot of nuances in how to study this and what's difficult about studying this or what's exciting about studying this. But I think a really sort of interesting high-level perspective here is that because we're doing this in an online world, we can start to study things that were kind of physically impossible before. So whereas in the traditional psychology lab, you couldn't erase people's memory, for example, very easily. In an online world, you can use a lot of kinds of interventions to really change what people feel and think. And so we're trying very hard to open up new kinds of experiments from that perspective.
Well, that's fascinating. So a lot of your research, and if we go back to your father and your mother, it does have a lot of your father's physicist impetus to really understand systems and so forth, but your mom's emphasis on humans and how they interact with the world they're given and they find themselves.
Absolutely.
You seem like you've really carried on both of their traditions and now sort of synthesizing it in different ways. So maybe a final question, Dr. Whiting. I've called you Mark most of the time, but let's end it formally, I guess. So if you were to, if someone were to ask you, should I do a PhD someday? what would you say, or what kind of advice would you give them?
Yeah, I mean, I think PhDs are very exciting. They're a great step into a really nice sort of lifestyle where you can pursue the problems that you care about and go very deep on subjects that you're inspired or excited by. I think PhDs are also hard, and they take time and they take a lot of effort. They take a lot of dedication. They're not short. And for most people who do a PhD, they could, you know, get a job that might pay them better, that may in some ways be a better option. The thing that I think really differentiates taking an academic career, like doing a PhD and being a researcher, over some of the other careers that you might take, for example, working at a tech company or working at a different kind of company, is that being a researcher gives you an unending source of questions and exciting sort of theory adventures. You can keep pursuing things that you care about and keep thinking about things that excite you for basically your whole life. And
whereas if you work at a company, you might end up in a product line for X number of years, and so that's your focus, as opposed to having a focus where like, oh, well, suddenly I find this other subject or question interesting, and then you're able to pursue that a little bit quicker versus in a different setting.
There's two factors that I'm getting at there. One is that you have less agency in a company usually. So usually you have somebody telling you what to do and you need to do that. And the other is that even if you do have agency, even if you're the startup, you know, founder and you're running the company where you want it to go, you're tied to not thinking about the thing too much, but instead thinking about how to make it work for people. Now, that's not bad, right? There's a lot of fun in making stuff work for people. But if you're really excited by how things work and what makes the world sort of the way it is, or if you have deep questions about, like, why does something happen in society or, you know, in humanity, or with some technical topic, then I don't think you're going to be satisfied by being in a company. I don't think you'll ever be satisfied by that. You'll always have these questions, and you'll never be able to get closer to answering them.
So if that's your reality, then a PhD is for you. If it's not your reality, then maybe, you know, a company is for you. That's another...
Sure.
That's the other side of what you just said. So I know you're in a time constraint, Mark. So thanks so much for being on being on the show today and sharing your story and your research.
Sure thing. It was very exciting. Happy to chat.
Excellent. Thanks, Mark. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to part 3 of the interview with Dr. Mark Whiting, who researches how to improve decision-making and coordination at individual, team, and societal scales. To continue listening, visit drz.net. That's dr-z.net. You can also follow me on Facebook at Dr. Z Podcasts and Instagram at drznet. As always, happy deciding. The People Behind the PhDs is conceived, written, produced, and edited by Dr. Z, that's me, Zachary Brooks, PhD, in Dr. Z Productions and Podcasts. Learn more at drz.net/about. That's dr-z.net/about.